Okay, so today we're going to talk about story. We're going to tell stories, right? I suddenly forgot. See, this is what happens when you put a record button on. My brain just flies out of my head.
You had a nice word on swapping stories or sharing stories, or what was it?
Try and get back to the web page. Why does it do this? It won't let me go back to see the event.
Trading stories. We announced it as trading stories.
Yeah, I like trading, exchange. I don't like sharing because sharing has this connotation of you're in an elementary school class and now we're going to share and it's nice to share. And it seems like fake, slightly manipulative things to me. I don't know. Maybe other people don't see it that way. What do you think, Gary?
I think it depends if... Sorry?
I'm asking Murray. What does he think? I know what you think.
It's a phrase that's used quite a little bit. I don't know how... technically, if you talk to another person, you're sharing something with them. Information or whatever, but it's not sharing in that we decided if there's two or three people that we're going to sit down and talk about a topic or something like that. It's just whatever comes off the top of your head or whatever you decide to bring to the table. And you're telling, yeah. And the other, you have a recipient who listens, so it's the transaction is done. The word sharing is, I think it's topical.
Maybe
people are going to share stories about a topic about, I was going to say grief, and that comes to mind because there's been a lot of, after the hockey bus accident last week, it sort of has consumed Canadian media in a great way. So that's the word that comes to mind immediately. But outside of that, having gone to a wake on Sunday for somebody's mother. If you had a topic, you would share stories around a topic or around a theme.
I'm talking about the word share used as kind of slightly manipulative. It's like, why don't you share with us? And it almost...
Oh, I do. Yeah, no, that's, yeah.
I don't know. It just seems to me like it's asking people for more than they wanted to give somehow. And also, there's like this oversharing thing, which means, spilling too much, being too personal, And so I think people are wary of the word share, which is why I don't really like to use it. Well, but I don't know what else to use. I do use it sometimes, but I'm not really happy with it.
Well, I think sharing is a very normal word, say, in therapeutic settings where people say, thank you for sharing your thoughts and things like that. I agree with you that when it's about normal story sharing in a story circle or... Well, yesterday I was reading Jonathan Carter's project in your More Working with Stories book. And I noticed your comments on the use of anecdote circle. But what I was trying to say, I was just looking up the stick protocol from Carl Weick that he uses for high resilience organizations. And there it is more in a team meeting that people share their what does it say here? Tell about the situation. What are we dealing with? That's the S of the stick protocol. And the task, what do we need to do? The intent, why are we doing this? So their sharing is more opinion or searching or almost sense-making like already in such a situation. While the sharing we are talking about here is sharing stories about a certain topic to get the sharing of stories going on.
Well, I mean, I just looked up, thank you for sharing. which is, I think, a movie, but it also comes up in this Urban Dictionary. Let me read you this thing. It says, a non-committal on the surface response, on the surface, parentheses, to a statement the phrase user finds unconventional, unacceptable, heretical, or bizarre. The undercurrent or true meaning is often, excuse me, I'm reading this, fuck you. It's always to denigrate or dismiss what was said. So what I'm saying is the word sharing has an extremely complex social usage. And that's why I'm wary of it. Because, you know, thank you for sharing can mean that was idiotic, but I'm not going to say that. And and also saying, would you like to share with us means I want you to perform in a way that you may not be comfortable with. So it's just, there's all this kind of weirdness attached to that word. And so, I don't know.
That's the big advantage of not being a native speaker. You don't get all that complexity and all that.
Yeah, but if you're talking to English speakers, you're gonna run into it. So.
Yeah, but aren't you guys so polite to think, okay, he's from the Netherlands, how can he know that there's so much complexity?
Well, it's hard to know what you
try some Dutch.
Well, there's some things that you know well. Another thing is that it's patchy. So, I mean, that's what happens when you're going from one language to the other. Some words are simpler and others are not. What do you think, Stephen?
Definitely influenced by television and the language they speak there. So,
yeah.
It's.
Well, yeah, I mean, it depends as well. Like, it does depend a bit on culture. I mean, I think if you say, I invite you to share, I've had this thing about invitation versus I'm allowing. So I'm going to allow you to share your stories as opposed to I invite you to share your stories.
Yes.
But I think it also does depend on the context.
Yes, it does.
I had that problem in the workshop when I was saying allow. And people in England don't really care about that. But some people in America on the West Coast were kind of funny about it. So, especially with an English accent, they suddenly started making all
You're going to allow it, are you?
Yeah. It's like, but I think there is a sense of, and this sort of comes back to the project, is where is this happening? Like I think Harold said that if you're in a therapeutic context, and then if it's a one-on-one therapeutic context, there's something, right?
Yeah.
If that's been established already, then in some ways, the word doesn't have to do all that work. Do you know what I mean? Or there's not that, it's like the trouble with Facebook, isn't it? There's no other cues to go on but the comment, you know? So, and I think that is also true with when you're crossing cultures or crossing. So I've been reading up some of the PhD work I'm doing, trying to look at some of this stuff around interdisciplinary, you know, cross-disciplinary work. It's all this problem, isn't it, of not knowing how the other people see things. And the whole thing of P&I is that you can transverse some of those barriers. But the point of engagement initially, you're probably still going to hit that problem. And I don't know if it's necessarily a universal cultural thing or whether it's in the moment. So I don't know if you've got stories of, like, how would you engage people? Like, do you have very different ways of engaging? I know sometimes you have a survey or you have a more of a customer engagement, and then there might be other times where there's been a workshop, you know. So I don't know what people's thoughts on that.
Well, when I like to talk about just regular people talking in regular conversation, I find the words exchanging or trading stories is nice because it gives us sort of one-for-one feeling of we're passing things around, you know. Although the problem is those terms can also be messed up because people are like, what? What? It's a barter? You know, is there money involved? I'm not sure if I answered the question you just raised.
Or just a give and take involved that is compulsory. Certainly we use the term sharing in the performance community, but it doesn't come with very much baggage. Because if somebody says, well, you know, we get together to share stories once a month and story swap, and it's an open, you know, it's not an open mic.
But it is swap. Swap's a good name. Swap.
And you don't have to be a member of the society to join in and that sort of thing. But when regulars like like myself are there and are going to, you know, give a story, everybody knows what it's going to be, more or less. I do a lot of Scottish background stories, so it might typically could be that or not. But there's no expectations that I'm going to, I guess that's what I'm saying. There's no expectations, and other people who are regulars, you know, we have a general idea of what they're going to do as well, and without expectation, and without any real baggage. But I think there's a baggage in therapeutic and that, you know, a different type of situation. Absolutely.
And I think also in performance, Murray, you've got that sense of like sharing is like a less intrusive thing than saying perform.
Yeah, that's true. That's
oh, yeah. Yeah, we don't perform use, would we be don't the other option. Perform, yeah.
When you perform your poem or share your poem,
yeah.
You would unusually ask someone to perform something in other environments.
Mm-hmm. Right. But I think that one word you just used, swapping, I think that's the best word actually. Because swapping is very informal. It's a sort of an old-fashioned term, and it doesn't have anything to do with exchange in the sense of you're required to do it. Every time I hear share, I flash back to being in Girl Scouts when I was 10, and they're like, today we're going to make a bead necklace that you hate and you're gonna love it, you know. And it's just, I feel so coerced when I hear that word. But swapping is an energetic word. It's everybody's engaged, and I'm going to start using that.
And it's used extensively in the performance area. We literally, on the website, it's called the Story Swap, and it happens across the countries with other regional organizations and even at the national conference, there's designated story swaps, and there are always two or three things about them. One, anybody can come and tell, mm-hmm. Limited only by the time in the room or whatever. And two, you can tell whatever you want. And three, you know, you're not being remunerated. It's not a performance thing. You're just there for the fun of doing it, and certainly in the Ottawa group that I belong to, and we use it as a test ground. I work hard to have a story ready for, it's once a month, of usually the first Thursday of the month, and I will often have a new story ready to at least present and get some. No, we don't do a critique and feedback, but you just put it out there and watch the audience. Plus you have a bad part in it, you tend to have a stumble on that, you know. You know, it's part of the process of learning and understanding exactly what you've got. I've gone to Story Swap and walked away thinking, well, that was a bit of a disaster, and it was a disaster because at somewhere around the 7-minute point of that story, it just doesn't hang together properly. And you go home and you go back to work on it, and that's really what. What's the phrase we like to use now? Not a danger zone. Nobody is making a judgment. It's a no judgment zone. You know.
Yeah.
Wide open. Yeah. And
speaking of which, we're supposed to be having one right now, so
yes,
we should stop talking about what the terms are and start doing the thing.
Yeah. Well, I just told a story about the term, didn't I?
I just looked up because I was a bit confused by swap.
Yeah.
But that's of course again because I'm Dutch.
So is there a Dutch term that maps to swap?
Yeah, that was I'm trying to find out. It says here in English, to interchange, to swap, to change, to exchange, to share, to switch, to trade.
Yeah,
trading stories was also mentioned.
Yeah, that's a good definition. Yeah,
but the thing is, swap has a more of an informal ring to it, and more friendly. It's not the same as like.
Huh? Is it more peer to peer like swapping? You change, you give a story, I tell a story.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah, in my experience, the people who turn up at Story Swaps are usually the tellers, swapping, that we would, less than 10% of any given audience are there just to listen because they like listening to stories. Most of us are there to we know each other, or even, well, no, we don't necessarily know each other. We have people who come in and we don't know, but everybody's there, tell a story and listen to the others.
I'm wondering about two things. First of all, what does the word that you call it do to the weaker voices around the table? If you call it swapping, or if you call it exchange or sharing, will that influence, say, the stronger or weaker voices? And the other thing is, most of the terms to me sound a bit like we say exchange, trade, give and take, or give and listen. Well, for instance, a word like offering a story. I'm trying to find what is the best word for what kind of group, for professionals, for what Cynthia calls the downtrodden. You could call it a story invitation. You're invited to share a story. Yeah, I'm not using the word share again. I wonder how you think about it. How do you engage people by using a different word? And are there any experiences on that? We always use share, delen in Dutch. It doesn't work, by the way. So I'm very intrigued by this. We do a lot of digital work, and I don't imagine to use the word swapping on the story point, because you're swapping with nobody usually.
Oh yeah, no, you couldn't use it unless it was a group of people actually talking together like we are.
You could have a virtual swap with the group.
Oh, absolutely. They don't have to be physically together.
Yeah, we don't have to physically be together, but no, you have to be collectively together in some manner or form. Yeah.
Well, Cynthia knows that I'm working on that story point model where that is it individual story sharing, and how public is the. I now actually turned it into a square, Cynthia. It was a triangle. You should just.
Oh yeah, but I saw the square. You showed me the square.
Yeah, and we are now talking to the guys in Regina if they can build something, sharing your story between the stories of all the other people, so that you have a kind of dashboard with a story sharing, and you see your dots appearing, and you see other people sharing stories. And then it could be swapping in a digital sense.
Ah, it's Mark. Hello, Mark.
Mark.
Hey.
We're supposed to be telling stories, and of course, we're talking about telling stories instead of telling stories.
That's part two.
We are recording, though, just so you know. Our new policy. So, but you said something, Harold, right now. You said, share your story. So now, if you type that into the internet, share your story means here's where you're going to tell us what we want you to tell us and nothing else. And so that's another part problem with the word share. It's become very directed. It's, share your success story. It's very circumscribed. You don't have a lot of freedom when you hear that phrase. And that's another reason I don't like it.
But I would also put in, if you think about this idea of top-down, bottom-up processing, I mean, whatever sharing means, we're taking that as a top-down process. We've got a sense of what we're saying it means, and we're going to apply it. Well, but it there's also a sense of.
Oh, I always try and start at the beat.
It can mean whatever, in a way. Like, the clean language could be helpful with this. Is for this exchange of stories to be the way that you'd like it to be. It'd be like what, and it might be. Yeah. That it's a swap, because the thing is, Murray's talking about a swap, but it's also implied that actually no one's going to swap in a performance context. It's like, it's not swap as in I'm going to tell a story, you can now start telling my story, and I'll take your story and start telling your story. It's not actually a literal swap in that context, it's more of a giving a sense of what it's not. It's giving a sense that it's somehow free. but it's people know whose story is what, I would imagine. You know what I mean? Because you have a certain ownership of it. In P&I, you're slightly different. So maybe there is a need to have a word at different times, but then you need to be able to qualify it in the context. Otherwise, it would never work, I don't think. It will always be different, because I see swap different, I think, to each of us see swap different, even if you speak English or share. And I see it different when I'm with this group of people to that group of people, you know. So there's, I think it's like you say, there's expectations are really important. But so sometimes you can't always qualify things, but that might be part of it. Maybe there needs to be a calibration process, and actually say, what is it that's going to happen here?
Well, sometimes I'll use a couple of different words depending on how people respond. But the thing you said about swapping, for me, the word has a very specific meaning, because in arts and crafts and doing, you know, knitting and all that, there's such a thing as a stash swap, where your stash is your bunch of stuff that you have to make things out of. So if you're a carpenter, it'd be wood. If you're a knitter, it's yarn. If you're a sewing person, it's a lot of material. And so people get together and they say, here's all the stuff I don't really want right now. Is there anything in it you want? And so people kind of swap. So swapping has this connotation of you know, one man's garbage is another man's treasure, or whatever it is, trash is another man's treasure. And it has this connotation of finding value in things and kind of this loose giving to each other, but in a way that makes everybody happy.
Yeah, it's a sense of community.
Yes, there's a sense of community to the word itself. And that's one reason I'm talking about.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
How did you call that, Cynthia? A swap stash?
A stash swap.
Stash.
Yeah, S-T-A-S. Yes.
S-T-A-C-H?
S-T-A-S-H.
S-A-H, okay.
Yeah, a stash is just stuff you have stashed away. And oh, it's a large one, actually. I've got several, actually.
It's a heap, a pile.
Yeah.
It has many meanings.
It's your materials that you use for whatever you're going to do.
To hoard. Well, that's what you do, Cynthia, with books.
What's that?
Exactly.
I didn't hear it. What was it?
I said that my translation says to hoard, and that's what you do with your books.
It is a hoard. Yeah.
You're a book hoarder, which is, by the way, a very good addiction.
Yeah. You know, at one time I was talking with these guys who collected things, you know, weird historical things and stuff, and they said, do you have a collection? I said, yeah, we have a lot of books. And they said, well, are they, you know, first editions? Are they this kind of books? And I said, well, no, we read them. And they're like, oh. They're like, that's not a collection. That doesn't count.
That's the same story about the library. What does the librarian do? Lend the books or keep them in order? Okay. Yeah, but this is getting very useful.
Telling stories, though. I did think of, I was trying to think of a good prompt for how we should choose stories. And I was thinking the best prompt is, since this is our first recorded call and a few people might listen to it, maybe the best prompt would be, what is the project that you've worked on that you think people would be most benefited from hearing about if they're interested in P&I? What do you think? Is that a good... Where did Stephen go? Disappear.
Stephen.
He's back.
Yeah.
Is that a good prompt, or should we do a different prompt?
Okay, so the prompt is sharing stories about projects you think people would learn a lot from about P&I. Okay. Yeah.
What do you think?
Mm-hmm. Well, my short story would be the first project I did, I learned the most, and it has diminishing since. Because your first project is your...
That's true.
Your biggest gap. And I think that what I learned the most is the surprise thing. that people start sharing stories about a subject they never thought they would share a story on, or swap a story, sorry. And I can remember my first project, we did it in the R&D of OC, and we did a timeline exercise with a heaven and a hell at the time. And I can remember that there were stories about other technologies that, that I couldn't relate to, and they turned out to be the surprising factor to the whole project, because they simply missed a couple of competitors. So that was that whole, people start, you have a prompting question, you make a timeline, people start sharing stories where you see people thinking, what does that have to do with it? And the end of the project in 2 hours, suddenly everybody says, shit, we missed a couple of competitors. And that starts in story sharing. That's, I think, one of the powers of D&I. So I think that it is important to hear this story because it shows what you can do in just 2 or 3 hours.
Yes. Okay, I'll do one. I would say that the story I think people most need to hear, and I cannot tell you when this happened, but it was more than 10 years ago. But the time that I figured out this rule of the most important stuff happens in the last quarter of the time, that when you have a bunch of people sharing stories together, and I think this was during one of these sessions that I suddenly realized that it often looks like nothing's happening in the beginning, and you have this time where you're like, oh my God, this is totally failing, and you're like panicking, and you have to just kind of shut up and let it happen. And if you have everything in place, it will happen. And in this one particular time that I can't really place when it was, but I remember sitting there kind of staring at the floor and saying, is this going to come together? And then it did. And the people started talking about really important things and getting energized. And the stories that started coming out were much different than the stories in the beginning, which were really hesitating and surface level, you know, that people kind of go down as they continue to talk. That I think people need to hear about that, even though I can't exactly say what it was or when it was or where or anything. But this moment when I realized that, oh, you actually have to go through a certain period of uncertainty and doubt before you break through to the good stuff. And that if you think everything's going wrong and you should like stop it or change it, you might just actually ruin it. I think that's something that people need to understand.
This is funny because, okay, let me now share a totally different story, which is exactly the opposite. We were doing a sense-making session in a healthcare organization, and like you said, there was uncertainty. In our case, it was more friction. It was more us against them and that kind of thing. And then at a certain moment, they looked at the landscape we were building, and one of them said, shit, we're on the same side. We're both on the side of the patients instead of you're from the patients, you're from the family, and we are from the system. And they said, oh, wait, that's the system. We are both on the patient side. And what happened at that moment was that the sense-making session was over. They had so much friction, and then they realized, okay, this is different than we thought. It was the end of the sense-making session. There were no story sharing anymore. People all felt that it was enough for the day. So we had coffee and we ate cookies and it got a friendly atmosphere. But we never did change or convergence. That was the converging moment, and it was enough. And I think that happens in some sessions, that there can be a moment when it's enough. Then it's no longer the facilitator that wants to facilitate the group to a certain end result, because it's not anymore in the scope of the participants to do that. So you have to be humble in that sense and leave it to the group how far they want to go that day. And in this case, they were very happy having another sense-making session 3 weeks later.
But how's that the opposite of my story? It sounds very similar, actually.
Well, what I mean is, you were talking about uncertainty and I was talking about clashing. And you were talking about, and then stories started sharing. In my case, it stopped. It was the end of the session. So it was not an energizing moment. It was more the moment things started to relax and people stopped working and they said, now we figured it out.
But there was still a resolution of some kind.
It's still a resolution, but the effect in my case was end of the session. In your case, it was energizing and stories started flowing. And in our case, energy was gone. So it almost sounds like two archetypical paths to a convergent moment, or let's say that a pinnacle moment.
Could be.
The tension.
That's probably.
Or there can be uncertainty, or there can be other feelings in the room. And then there is, a good sensing session, there's always a couple of these click moments.
Cynthia's description it reminds me of the classic, you know, sort of session where nobody wants to speak first and everybody is looking for how safe the whole thing is going to be, and which is why things do happen in the latter part, because by then everybody who has been doubting, or most people who have been doubting, or let me put it this way, enough, will then come forward and tell a story or tell their story or whatever. Because there is an aura of safety in the room, and they're not, for whatever, the whole psychological gambit of that.
Anybody have another story about a thing that people need to hear about?
Well, I just counted the number of projects yesterday, and I'm now going to...
Yeah, well, it's hard to pick anything. Maybe we need a different prompt. Maybe something about how we were surprised. I mean, I think surprise has been something that's emerged for me as really important, to the point where I'm almost starting to describe the entire thing as surprising yourself.
Oh, and can you elaborate on that? In surprising yourself?
Well, I mean, as a community, as an organization, as a collective. That the person running the project, it doesn't matter if they're surprised or not. It matters if the people who are involved are surprised. And every successful project, every project that I consider a success, involved some element of surprise for somebody. And almost always the surprise is a very useful surprise that they can then go and do something about.
Yeah, basically you're describing a breakthrough of some type for...
Yeah, and sometimes it's an unpleasant surprise in the sense that they learn something about themselves that they would rather not have known, but they can still use it.
Well, another thing that might drive a project is when people, maybe intrigued is not a good word, but satisfied with the activities in the project. And what we recently try to do is get results very early, do very short cycles, that you have a couple of successful story swapping. I need to learn this new vocabulary, Cynthia. You need to rewrite the book.
Yeah, I'll say that.
Can you do a final replace on sharing?
It's not necessary. I think what Stephen said is correct, that it depends on context. If you've already established a context in which you can say the word and it won't mess up anything, it's fine. But if you haven't established a context, it can be dangerous because it can put you into a context you didn't mean to be in.
Well, the danger of saying your 7 or 6 phases thing is that for us also, in the beginning we thought, okay, we got a sharing phase, a catalysis phase, a sense-making phase. But when you read the book, and we are trying to do that more and more now, why not have a story-sharing, sense-making, some outcome session of, say, 2 or 3 hours where people have a take-home or at least a tangible result. And so that's a cycle in 3 hours.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's what I always tell people. When people come to me and they say, okay, we're going to do this big project. It's going to take 6 months. I'm like, okay, stop.
Yeah.
Get 6 people, go to a room, give yourself 2 hours, and go through it really quickly, because before you do that, you can't plan the big project. You have to see it work on the small scale or your big scale isn't going to work.
Well,
and a lot of people, they don't even want to do that before they plan the big thing because they think they understand how it works, but I don't think you can.
Well, I think it should not even be do that before you do the big thing. We did one project for Dutch Rail where we took a couple of phases and we said, okay, we do story sharing around the table, we do some sense making, we build up the story point, and then we do a small story collection digital and we do it again, and then we do a big email shot, and then we go to Twitter. So it was blah, blah, blah. It got bigger and bigger, and it was 5 or 6. We just called old 2 cycles, but we did 7 because we simply didn't execute the project plan.
Mm-hmm.
Rule number 1 in P&I, never look at the project plan. No, but I think that's an important thing, that you should try to get the thing, to keep the thing going and growing if you want to grow, but it shouldn't be small and then big.
Oh, no, I didn't mean that. I meant start with that one thing and then you can move up from it, yeah.
Build it up over time, get new people in, let the project, the story sharing grow, yeah. Do you have a similar, somebody has a project, say, that followed that dynamic? Something that started small, grew, became a cloud. Stefan, you have one in the theater phase? Stefan is gone.
I don't know. He's kind of coming and going, I think, because he's dealing with...
Yeah, he had to let his wife into the building. He just said on the chat.
No, but he said that a while ago. So I don't know if... I think we have to just assume that he has to come and go because of the events in his life recently. I should say that he has a baby. That someone listening to the recording, they might not understand it. I have so much trouble talking about projects because I'm having trouble saying, okay, what can I say and what can I not say? And also a lot of the projects were long enough ago that I have very fragmentary memories of them. And also, a lot of the projects that I have worked on, I've been more tangential to it than, so I can't say a lot of what happened because I don't know a lot of what happened. But and what was the question again?
Well, a project that grew over time, that started.
Oh, right, right. Yeah, actually, I can think of several things like that where one of the things that we've always done, that I've always done, is that we get a champion. Somebody who kind of gets it, and like they work at a big corporation or a government agency, and they say, hey, this is cool, and then they go around kind of shopping it to people to get internal funding to do it, and so they get a little bit and they do a little thing, then they can then go and tell some other people about that, and then they kind of grow it inside their thing. And so I can think of several projects where a person did that and we helped them do that. And that in a way, it had to happen that way, but it was a good way anyway.
So your role was pretty limited then? It was just in the initiation and
well, it's more like support. Well, kind of like support, back end, coaching, that kind of thing.
Okay.
I don't really do a lot of like actually collecting the stories or facilitating that much, just because I hate traveling, really.
We did one project where we had to go to the half of the, say, formal side of the organization, you got all Dutch names for it, but say the patient council and the employees council and the technical council. And what we discovered there, that it was better to do a small P&I exercise with them, a story sharing exercise, and have them work with the stories for 20 minutes and giving a presentation on what P&I was about and what the project would deliver. Because people, even if you're trying to help people get funding or get, how you say that, support for a project, I think the best way to do it is to do small P&I, or at least parts of P&I, or let people experience a bit of it while you try to convince them, than trying to convince them without doing it. And it's much better, because people have to experience that after sharing 10 stories, somebody says, I think I see a pattern here that I never saw before. It was all unrelated. And now maybe that impression is wrong. It doesn't matter. But they experience something that's new to them. And you only need one or two people in a room that say that. And then they say, okay, now I get it too. So it's a very good, doing P&I is a very good way to convince to get support for P&I.
Mm-hmm. And I think that a lot of the repeat things that I've worked on have been in that vein where we've started with something small as a proof of concept. And then they say, okay, we get it. Let's do more. But it just so happens that that's the best way to do it anyway. So like, even if they had started with, we totally get it and we want to do it, you'd still start that way.
Yeah. Even though the vision is big and grand and we could go there, we always say start small and determined. Small but determined. Maybe that's, I'm not sure if that translates right. But because if it's pilot or let's try this, then it doesn't work because then it's not serious enough. Let's learn this. Let's do this. Let's grow this. That kind of words is what you need. Let's find out together that kind of thinking. Let's develop this. Let's go that direction. That's the kind of words you need.
I'm actually just looking over my project list now to trigger my memory. And another thing I'm realizing is that networking has a lot to do with this. So a lot of the projects I've worked with on were, there was a project done by somebody in some department. And then after that, they told their friends in other departments or, you know, other divisions of the government or whatever. And then it kind of sort of blooms out into related areas. And so there's a kind of repetition in that too, in that I'll have a project that says department of something or other. And then there's another one the next year by, you know, some fairly related department. So it's kind of a word of mouth kind of thing. Maybe people tell the story to somebody else and then they hear it and they want to try it.
Okay. The first, when you started to talk about networking, I assumed you meant that doing a P&I project has a networking effect in the sense that people discover each other through the stories, but you're talking about a network of projects. One project leads to the other, leads to the other, leads to the other. Yeah, okay.
Business networking is
personal. Yeah. What's happening? You should only do projects for people that do, what's the sport? This one.
Baseball or golf?
No. On greens. What all the businessmen do.
Oh, yeah, that's golf.
Golf, yeah. Only do projects for people that play golf.
Well, what I've noticed is that when people do a project and they're satisfied with it, they tend to tell other people the story of what happened.
Yeah.
And then other people are like, oh, that sounds great. We want to do that too.
Well, we have one customer that was very unhappy about the result of his project, but it was due to his own organization. And he's a big supporter also. His people simply didn't buy in and he was pissed off of them. He said, "You got such a big chance and you don't take it."
Well, I do think that it goes the opposite way too, which is that if someone has a bad experience, that spreads too. And what I found is that, and I have had a few mistakes where collectively between all the people who were working on it, we've made mistakes and it didn't turn out the way people wanted. And what I found works is to be very honest about what mistakes were made and talk about it and figure out, you know, instead of saying, oh, that never happened, to be ready to sort of learn from it and not make those mistakes again.
But the funny thing here was that the project didn't work because he thought he had authority to say, let's do this. And he was pissed off as his staff that they didn't take it. And the funny thing is, they were change managers. It was 40 change managers that refused to change.
They didn't want to share any stories of their experiences.
Yeah, well. So, is that a story? Yeah, that's a story.
Yeah. Okay, here's another prompt. I hope we'll get Stephen back soon. Here's another prompt is, what is a project that you're really proud of that you know, that you look back and you think, I'm proud of what I did there? And it can be pretty broad, you guys, if you want to, you know, say some other, I mean, it doesn't have to be exactly P&I, it can just be sort of story related.
Proud. I'm discovering the embarrassment rule every 3 months, so that destroys pride.
Well, your pride can be mixed with humility in that you learned not to. I mean, I think I've learned not to do something on every project.
Proud. Well, I think that this rail project where we managed to get a positive result, feedback from the customer, even if they only had 25 positive stories about them. They had 700 stories, and we collected them by sending 120,000 tweets, and some 600 people responded. And of these 8,000 people responded, 700 left a story and finished the whole thing. That struck us, by the way, that people that start with sharing a story, and once they have answered two or three questions, they tend to complete the whole thing, even if it's six screens, because they've already invested so much in sharing a story that they will complete the thing. That was an aside. But in this project, we had something like 25 or 27 stories that were positive. And the customer said, thank you, because it's the first positive stories we heard through digital media lately, because it's always complaining on Twitter, shit on Facebook, and people. Of course, if you delay a train, if a train gets delayed, you got 800 pissed off people. I mean, which is very hard to upset to offset by a good action from staff. That's just one or two positive stories in that whole train. Sorry. So we're quite proud of that. That we said, negative stories, and what's the customer thing? And actually, the weak signal, the 25 positive stories, which all turned out to come from the weekend, by the way. That was the negative. It only happened on weekends, positive things in trains. But yeah, that's something I think I'm proud of.
When people weren't in quite such a hurry?
No, it was that staff had time for the trains weren't very. Usually in traffic rush hour, you have to stand in the train because 4 million people take trains. Okay. And trains are 2 kilometers long, that kind of thing. And it's all very crowded. The country is too small for the number of people on trains. But in the weekend, trains are half empty, they're shorter, and staff has time to talk to people, to do nice things, to engage with people, and that's where the positive stories came from. So there was one story that somebody made a joke. So the train, how do you call it? The guy that steers the train that's in front?
Was the
engineer.
Was the train. Oh, sorry? The driver. Yeah, or the engineer. So the engineer is a traditional North American term. But
the train driver made a joke through the intercom in middle of rush hour, And that was the only other positive story that we had from Monday to Friday, because the whole train started to laugh, and all the, it was 1,600 people or so on the train, like we later heard, because somebody typed in the train number where it happened. And that story was one of the few positive stories.
That is a difficult thing to tell a joke in that situation that actually engaged most of the people on the train. Because I would think in other situations you'd probably have a 50-50 split where half the train would laugh and the other half would be just as grim and grumbly as they were moments earlier.
If I remember well, it was a joke about the destination of the train, given the fact that the train was so fully loaded, and they started from the capital, from The Hague. And he used a funny word for the destination. He said something like, apparently half the population of the capital wants to go to the other city. And he called it Toki Toki Land, which is a bit of the downtrodden area. And so a lot of people started laughing on that joke. And there were a couple of stories in our database that had that kind of... Maybe that's the thing I'm most proud of. Dutch Rail said it's because of this kind of stories that we will start instructing our staff to engage more. Because people feel then that they're not anonymous, even though they don't see anybody in person, because you can't check, you can't go to a train if it's fully packed. But if you say something to the intercom, and that was something that was always forbidden before.
Oh, I'm sure, yes.
The driver or the technician or the engineer shouldn't interact with the customer because it was the job to drive.
Yeah.
Maybe we, in this situation, should allow them to say things to the passengers and talk about the train that's too crowded, or so they sort of change the communication protocol.
Meanwhile, the job application now has a section for your past as a stand-up comedian.
Yeah, that would be a good thing.
Stand-up comedy.
I'm not sure there will be many applicants, but
you're going to have a large train with a lot of people standing up.
A stand-up comedian for a standing train. Yeah,
different concept of stand-up. Yeah.
Well, yeah, they ordered new trains, and it takes something like 4 years to build. So,
yeah,
it's like ordering an aircraft or an aeroplane. It also takes very long.
We got our first train in another 7 months. The first LRT that will run through the center of Ottawa.
Okay.
Yeah, it was supposed to start in May, but it's been delayed. About 5 months. The trains are ready. They will start doing the testing on the system in the summer, and then at some point in autumn, they'll be open for business. Yeah. Well, I'll be riding it from time to time, so I'll have to just see how they, whether they have any jokes or not. Yeah. Unfortunately, it doesn't go very far. Phase two, if it goes through the center of downtown, but it will be really phase two that will make it a true commuter system, which will be another 4 years before that opens. Yeah.
Well, I think that pride thing, Cynthia, can go two ways. The first could be towards the people that shared and worked with stories. When people show gratitude, or they say thank you, or I hope something is going to happen with these stories, it will have an effect. That's one side. Mm-hmm. The other side is when the customer is happy, when they actually probably didn't get the results they thought they would give, but still are happy with what they got or what they think they can do with it. And it's a bit of a...
Well, actually, the Ideal Project has both.
Yeah, I know.
Sometimes you get more of one, and sometimes you get more of another. And also, sometimes there's a project where you get all of one and none of the other, and that's not good, because one group or the other is not happy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, the good news is if the customer is happy and the participants are not, you often get a second chance to repair that. The other way around, it doesn't work.
That is true. Yeah, that's true. Whereas if the participants are happy and the funders are not, you're done.
Yeah, yeah. I can remember one. Something about soccer, right?
Something about what?
Soccer.
Soccer. Oh, yeah. Yes, exactly. Yeah, that's what I was thinking of, actually.
Yeah, the customer was not happy with the contents of the project. Yeah, we can't help that.
People were so happy to be heard.
Exactly.
But then the funder was like, well, that's enough of that. Let's put that up. Yeah.
But that's a bit of sticking the head in the sand, and then, you know, you've
absolutely.
You're not looking for everybody's opinion. I'll make it very brief, and then you didn't like what you hear, so you stick it in the file drawer. That doesn't solve any problems.
There's been quite a lot of that, actually.
Yeah.
In fact, I find that's the more likely thing, seems to me. Unless maybe I'm just not. Maybe those were my mistakes, but.
We talked about that before. I think what you see a lot with first B&I projects is that people start with a safe thing. They start with customers. They start with whatever. They don't start in the core. On the other hand, we've noticed, and we just discussed this last week, that the most successful projects are usually the ones where professionals or staff is involved.
So yes.
When it's about their work, when it's about their stories, their experience, and by the way, these projects are also easier to sell because the customer pays for something. He invests in his own organization. Even if it is shit that arises, he knows what to.
Yep.
If the shit arises from customers, it's shit, these customers. But if it's in its own organization or the organization, it's very hard to deny that something should be done about it, unless it's 12 steps down in the hierarchy and they don't care. But in medium-sized organizations or more mundane, civil organizations, people actually care that there are staff members that have a big have a problem more. And so last week we talked about maybe we should stop selling citizen projects to government, and maybe we should say, okay, why don't you start with getting work experience from your own civil servants about serving people, and then ask their stories about experience as a citizen while being employed as a civil servant. And then go to the partners, and then as an onion go outward, because then the organization can get adjusted to working with stories from the kernel to the outer. While the first reaction of the customer is, "Oh, let's try the citizens," it's also the biggest problem to make that into a successful project that goes into the heart of the people that run the project from inside the organization. So we now think it's better to start in the core of the organization to have them look at their own project problems or challenges or whatever, and then go outward. But it's still theory, but that's what we can try.
That makes sense.
And Harold, when you do that, would you say that's like two projects in a way? There's an internal, maybe organizational development change type project, and then there's a...
Well, for example, say you have a 20,000 people organization and they want to have research done on how it is to live in the city of The Hague, whatever. Why don't you ask your employees that live in The Hague to share stories about how it is to live in The Hague? Why do you have to go to normal citizens? They're in your own organization. And if that's already a step too far, you can start with how is it to work in this organization? And then as a next project, how is it to live in this environment? Or how is it to... So usually your own staff has stories that you can use for projects that you would otherwise say, okay, why don't you go? Why don't you ask citizens? Well, you've got 20,000 citizens in your own organization, so you simply look at the roles people have. I think if you go to the Department of Healthcare and you want to do a project on the quality of a certain aspect of healthcare, why don't you ask the civil servants? They have children. They have experience with the healthcare system, and it's much more, it's much safer to ask your own employees and get stories and do a project than you have to go out to the patients of a hospital and expose yourself as doing a project on the quality of healthcare. So, as I said, your theory, but we are more thinking about what stories are inside the organization that help the organization learn from the experience of their own staff, instead of always going to the patients, always going to the citizens, always going to the customers.
That's a good idea.
He agrees.
We have another participant.
Yeah.
Just give her the jinga. Yeah. That makes sense. I mean, we did that a little bit when we did a test pilot for the water project for the social drama topography, because we started to test out the stories and the process with the staff, obviously thinking about what it would be like with the clients. I mean, I suppose the only time that falls down is when you're dealing with people whose lived experience is different to what the staff's lived experience could be. If they're more marginalized or something, but it still makes sense. How do you find time though? Because obviously then people will feel like, oh, our time is valuable in a workplace. But I suppose
I was trying to say, the idea is you start a project in the core organization on something that is a challenge for the core organization. You can't do a marginalized women project with the staff of a department. What you can do is another P&I project that helps them communicate better, look at their culture, whatever. And that enables them to experience P&I for one of the projects they work on. And then it's, or one of the problems they experience. And then do the outside project with the marginalized people, because then the customer organization has already experienced D&I. And of course, it's a longer route, but I think building, how say that, acquaintance, and building experience, building a track record, letting people experience what it is, I think it's just as important as doing the first, the wanted project right away. And even if you do a bigger project and they want to do the marginalized people, why don't you start with a small P&I project for the core of their organization to let them experience what it is before you go outside? Because it reduces the discussion afterwards, like, where's my result? Where are my conclusions? Where is my consultancy report?
No, that's a good idea, actually.
Are you involved beyond... When does the process end for you, Harold, in a project? When does the project end for you when they've had this sense-making and they've got some results, or are you also involved beyond that in correcting the problem, or
well of course
in that
we don't correct the problem, but in most project plans, helping the organization come up with a set of interventions they design and carry out is usually the end of a cycle.
Okay.
And then the question is, do you want to listen to the stories about what happened to the interventions and then do another cycle? Well, we just had this discussion last week. Should we actually offer a certain endpoint in the project, or simply say, let's go on this journey and see how far we get given the amount of budget there is? We always try to break what's called, I think, in engineering, the iron triangle of quality, cost, and what is it? Quality, cost, and time. Mm. When you make a quote for a project, you're usually pressed to fix a point somewhere that says, I will deliver this for that kind of money in that kind of quality. But most of the P&I projects involve innovation. They involve people changing their mind. And that's something you can't predict, you can't design. We mentioned surprises all the way. So now we are thinking, why don't we sell projects and say, okay, we will work on this for 4 days a month. We will go with the flow. We will talk about progress. And we will see when it ends. Either budget is out, but most organizations don't have that problem. If they're bigger, then the budget we take is usually not a problem. The problems arise when you sell a project where you say, I will deliver this at that quality in that period, because then there are surprises and they surprise you.
Yeah. Usually you can only get two of those.
Exactly. You can only fix two out of three, and most customers want to have three out of three, because it's called smart buying or smart project, measurable, protocol. Yeah. It's basically very stupid for innovation, but that's another thing. Yeah. But unfortunately, I don't have to yet on that kind of.
You don't have what?
I don't have stories about projects that we offer that way. Although we had one project where we actually did it that way, because the customer changed his mind in 2 weeks. We had made a complete project plan. We started the project, and then after 2 weeks, the customer came up with new requirements or new ideas. And that was the moment when we took the opportunity and said, okay, if you want to do extra things, that's fine, but that means that we don't know how far we will get into the project plan. He said, okay, that's okay. And so we simply started counting days and counting hours. And when the hours were up, it was the end of the project. And we tried to end that at the moment where he was happy. By the way, that was the same project that I talked about with the change manager. So, but it was fortunately two projects side by side, one with patients and one with change managers in care organizations. So we actually did one, although it wasn't sold as one.
I have a story for the proud thing, but does anybody else want to say one first? Or
no, you can go.
You may go.
Thank you. Well, I was just looking through the story. Actually, I can't say the project I'm most proud of, because it's not really, doesn't make sense. It's not a linear thing, but I can see an example of that. And I think that it really comes down to I'm proud of when I feel like I've given someone a voice who didn't have one before, or maybe someone who wasn't taken seriously by other people before, and then they get heard for the first time. And the one that I'm thinking of is one that was done for a ministry or department of education for a government. And they wanted to look at what is education and what creates a successful education. And we asked students and parents and teachers all the same questions. And I don't know how many stories it was, but I'm guessing it was like a couple of hundred stories. And this was one of the first projects that I got a lot of stories dumped on me, this was back probably about 15 years ago, maybe something like that. I didn't even have any statistics yet. It was just all eyeballing and looking at graphs and things. But so we had all these stories, and we had asked questions specifically about the behavior of the people in the stories, because it was kind of like, what is the kind of attitude or frame of mind that leads to good education and good learning, right? So one of the things that sort of jumped out of the data at me was that there were certain things that were describing people's behavior that had to do with sort of weakness. And they were things like being lazy, not being motivated, being afraid, or just being weak. And then there were other things that were kind of more forceful, like being arrogant or lying or being selfish. And so it was like sins of omission or sins of commission, or you could say it as just weakness versus positive malice, right? And so I said, well, that's interesting that there are these different ways of describing people. I wonder if there's any connection between them. So I made these graphs where I said, okay, and then they gave kind of a sliding scale for all these different things. So like someone was extremely weak in this story, or someone was very dishonest in this story. And so surprisingly, I found a correlation between the two things. And this correlation was, it looked like a line, okay, because I didn't really have any statistics at that point. But and that was really interesting, because I was like, well, why would you equate being afraid or weak with being bad? You know, that seems like a strange way to approach education. I mean, here, you know, in my mind, I had this picture of this little kid. Well, the truth is, I remember this, being called up in front of the class, right? Everybody does. And you have to perform, and you can't, and you're afraid, and it's just like, you know, everybody's bad dream, right? Is being asked to do something and you can't. And so I'm picturing this little kid freaking out, right? And I'm thinking, how could anyone think that there was something bad about that? So then I'm looking at, and I said, well, let me just parcel it out, because we had marked whether stories were from students, parents, or teachers. And so when I pulled the different sets apart, it turned out that the correlation was fairly strong, in the sense of you could see lines, for the teachers, but weak for the parents and non-existent for the students. So then they all indexed the same stories. They all answered questions about the same stories. So the same story, a teacher saw it, well, not every one of them, but on average, the teacher saw it as a weak student is, you know, basically you got to get up there and do what's required of you. And if you're weak, well, you just got to work harder. Whereas the parents kind of had a medium of that, and the students didn't have it at all. They were like, no, you know, that's not true. That, and I thought, well, that was a really striking trend, you know? And so I put it into this report, which is possibly the first report I ever made. I'm not sure. It might have been within the first five or something. And I didn't call it catalysis then. It was just a straight up report, because we thought that's what they wanted. So we send this report back, right? And oh my God, they were absolutely furious. And the emotion that came out in this department of, these were not teachers, they were people who work on education, right, in the government. They were furious, and they started attacking me personally, and saying, you don't know what you're talking about, you're not professional, you're an idiot, how could you write such a thing about us, about teachers, about our teachers, you know, how could you label them like that? And I didn't know what to do, because I was like, well, I'm just telling you what I saw on the data, and anyone could see it, I'm looking at it right now. That, you know, in one group it's this really strong correlation, and in the other groups it's fuzzy. And I didn't, I got to the point of, I just stopped answering my email. I stopped checking my email for like a week. I was like, I need to quit doing this, because this is not working. You know, this is obviously not what people want if they're just going to scream at me because of what we found, you know? So the person that I was working with at the time, I mean, I could not have done this, but the person I was working with at the time said, okay, I think what you're saying is really there. And so what he did was he went to two or three of the schools that we collected the stories from. He went to the principals of the schools. He sat down in their office and he said, look at these pictures. Do you see these graphs? Is this true or is this not true? And the principal said, oh, it's totally true. That's so obvious that the teachers, yeah, that's our experience. The teachers are very judgmental of the kids and they just get down on those kids who are afraid and weak and whatever, and just, you know, kind of try to bully them into trying harder. And so he's like, yes, totally true. And then he said, will you come to this department and tell them that? And he said, then they said, sure. So he got two or three of these principals to go and have a meeting with them. And then when they sat down with the principals and the principals said, yes, this is really happening, then the people said, oh, well, that's different then. And let's see what we can do about that. And then I don't know what happened after that, but my hope is that some little kid in some classroom who'd been being, you know, harassed by their teacher maybe had a little easier time, and that maybe I had a little part to do in that. So I'm kind of proud of that project. Well, for that reason, that maybe some little kids were helped or whatever. But the other reason I'm proud of that is that even though it was a really horrible experience and I considered just quitting the entire field because of it, because it was so painful to have people attacking me, that's where Catalysis came from. That project was when I said, okay, I'm never going to go through this again. And I also said, obviously we're doing this wrong if all we're doing is making people angry. And that's when I came up with a thing of, okay, every time I see a graph, I'm going to say it means A, no, it means B. And I'm going to like split that in half, because that way nobody can find me, right? If you don't know which one of the things was my idea, it was my belief, and I changed the order up and everything, then there's no me in that report. It's just a bunch of stuff. And then I don't know if it was the next, probably was not the next project, but a little while after I started doing that, I was talking to a person that I'd given a report to, and he said, well, you know, some of these things, we read them, and because he was using it in a session, he said, some of the stuff we looked at and we were like, oh yeah, that's totally true. And some of the other things were like, what the heck are they talking about? That doesn't make any sense. And I was like, oh good, it's working. Because by giving people this kind of mess of things, they have to kind of come back and think, well, what do we think about it? And the option of just attacking me and walking away was no longer available. And so I was really excited and proud that I'd kind of worked out that solution to the problem that is, you know, helpful to people. So that's a project that I definitely feel proud of. Done. Whoa.
That's really helpful, actually, Cynthia. That's really, really useful, that story, for me.
How so?
Well, I'm looking at this idea of mixed methods research and all this sort of stuff, and I think we're talking about narrative. And I think what that speaks to is you get trapped in this middle. Like, most research has to go through so many levels and so many ethics levels to say this is how it is, certainly based on someone's interpretation. Because like you say this is just what the data says, but as you can see, that was a good proof that it doesn't. It's basically, because that's not how it normally works. It normally works that someone is reading into that. So by getting the school teachers to actually make sense of it, it allows you to move beyond research into inquiry.
Yes.
Because that's the trap. Because there is a legitimate concern by the people that were getting angry at you, because they've got a researcher coming in, and the implication is this is a general universal thing, because that's how research kind of works. You see what I mean? So the threshold to make it to that, I mean, you could do an investigation, and it also links in actually to the chair on my PhD. He did his PhD back in the 70s or 80s on teachers, and it was about children, really troubled children, and why they get booted out of school. And it sort of speaks a bit to how practice-based PhDs are sort of useful, because it kind of allows a bit more of what you did. But he found that when he spoke to the teachers that were kicking kids out, the defining factor of whether the child would be kicked out was whether the teacher felt undermined in their confidence in their ability to manage the class. That makes sense. Yeah. They almost, it's not how bad the kid behaved, but if the teacher felt that their sense of identity and their competence to be able to stand there and feel able to lead the class was being undermined too much, the kid gets excluded.
Wow.
That was interesting.
Yes.
So anyway.
That would also not be well received, I would think.
No, but well, yeah, I mean, yeah, exactly. He was working within, yeah, I didn't ask him about that, but well, he was doing a whole PhD on it, and that was his field. So you've also got this thing that you're kind of like a mixed method researcher coming in when we do P&I, unless what I'm doing is I'm sort of building it into my own projects. So I'm kind of doing a bit of what Howard says, but I'm also trying to do it so I can do it on people. So you've got this interesting ethical question about, are you being a researcher who's coming in from outside? Are you sort of more of a embedded strategy role, and what type of data is being used and how? And so I think that was a really good lesson, because by bringing it back to a sense making rather than a, this is definitive, like you were saying, this seems to indicate, but really, unfortunately, social science at the moment is absolutely a mess. And there's so much dodgy stuff going on because they do so much research where they already know the answer and they already know what they're going to say. And they're just going in to do the research to confirm it. And no one trusts anyone. Not that no one, but there's a lot of utter BS out there. So for me, that's really good. That's a really good, it makes me understand catalysis a bit more anyway, because I, and to be honest with you, I'm a bit confused with catalysis. So catalysis is really like, in its pure form, where it would end. In most research, you just do the story collection.
No, it isn't actually, you wouldn't do it at all. You just do straight up analysis, which is what I did on that report.
Exactly. So you drifted. Very,
yeah, and it was, but there's two other things about that project, which is that was one of the first projects that I did a report on, and I wouldn't do it for a long time. And our original thing was that we would have the data and we had the software, and we would, get groups of people in a room. We tried to do the catalysis in the sense making, right? And we would say, okay, here's what we're going to do. We've got the stories, we've got the graphs. You're going to sit in the room. We're going to have a whole bunch of laptops lined up, and we're going to lead you through an exercise where you're going to look at the patterns. And the people would just say, no, we won't do it. And we were like, okay. You know, they're like, we want a report. We don't want to look at software. We don't want to touch buttons. We want pictures and explanations. And so, and I kept saying, no, 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 I won't do that. And the people I was working with were like, well, the client is demanding this. We can't really say no. And so I said, all right, fine, I'll write a report. And I don't know if that was the first one, but it was within, you know, maybe some other one didn't go that way. But, and so that backfired. But there was one other, oh, I know. We said, well, writing this report is okay because they know that the graphs and the pictures we have are derived from the interpretations of the stories that people made themselves. So we ask people questions about the stories. Here's their answers. All I'm showing you is their answers. And these are the graphs that we have. But even that, even my saying, do you see this graph? Do you see this graph? Looks to me like it shows this. That was enough to infuriate them. That the looks to me like it shows this part was the part that infuriated them. But without that, they wouldn't accept it. We couldn't just show them the graphs, because we had several clients who were just like, we don't want graphs. We want answers. We want you to tell us what the graphs mean. And so then I say what the graphs mean, and they freak out. So I was like, okay, we're in a position here where, you know, it's damned if you do, damned if you don't. So, and that was where catalysis was born out of, is that, okay, here's your answers, but there are lots of weird answers, and I deliberately threw in some crap. It's basically the trickster thing. It's saying, you know, I'm lying to you, but I think it's going to be useful anyway. And if you can get people over that hump, and I used to put a thing at the beginning of every report, in fact, I still do, saying that mixed in with the stuff I actually think is a lot of deliberate lies, and that's to help you. And here you go. And, you know, sometimes people need a little bit of talking to get before they get that. But Well, individually, sometimes it doesn't work so well, but if you have a group of people, they usually get it right away. They're like, okay, great, we'll use this. Because it just mixes with what you do in a group. Everybody has a different opinion, so here's just some more, you know?
So you have to have a sense-making session then, basically, though.
Yeah, you do. If you take a thing like that and just show it to one person, all they're going to do is just cherry-pick the bits they like. Whereas if you have it in some sort of group discussion, then it is this catalyst, as it should be, to get all these things moving.
Right. I wasn't clear. I never knew that before.
Yeah, so that whole thing was sort of born out of pain.
Yeah, I didn't realize that catalysis, you might mix in a range.
Oh, that's the point. And then when I do it, and the way I describe to do it is you have a graph, you say, okay, this graph looks like it's important. And then you say, okay, the way I do it, I say, okay, obviously it means this. And I type that, you know, one sentence. And then I go like this, I cross my arms and I pretend I'm somebody that I disagree with. And I've got a large selection to choose from, right? Lots of relatives and friends and people I disagree with about lots of things, right? And I be one of those people and say, well, obviously that's wrong and it means this other thing. And then I type that in. And if I can come up with a third, I do that. And then I switch the order up so you don't know which was the one I thought. And that's kind of the way you do it.
Just one question. I know. What do you do then in the sense making when you bring that in? Because now you do you then use that to steer the conversation in the sense making?
Well, what I usually do is that people are in groups and I give them tasks. So the task is, as a group, you're going to look through these different patterns and the interpretations, and you're going to sort of pick one that sort of speaks to you, and then you're going to talk about it. And then you're going to talk about these different interpretations. Which one do you think is right? Which do you, you know, is there another one that we didn't think of? You look at the graphs, you look at the interpretations, you talk about it. Maybe you look at some other graphs and you make a case for something, but you basically use that to start talking about it.
Cynthia, you said something about putting in nonsense or putting in noise. Do you mean really deliberate nonsense, or do you mean other perspectives that are seriously?
Well,
or people might consider as nonsense given their normal perspective. Is it all in the catalysis reports I saw was more like, oh, that kind of person would give that interpretation to this pattern?
Well, the reason I say nonsense is that some of the perspectives that I come up with when I sort of channel these other people are perfectly nonsensical to me, but they're not to them.
Okay.
So what looks like noise to one person is a signal to somebody else. So, and in fact, this is connected to a thing called steganography, which is a method of encryption, which is to hide the signal in a lot of noise. It's a way to obscure anything, really. So that's kind of the point, is to obscure any of your actual interpretations that come from your own perspective as the person who's looking at the data.
And the other thing I was thinking, suppose you've got a project with teachers, principals, and the project you told about. Do you use that kind of roles, say, in making interpretations? What would the typical teacher say about this? What would the principal say? Do you use that in catalysis?
Yes. It actually took me a long time to realize that when I'm doing the catalysis, I'm actually pretending to be some of the people who told some of the stories.
Ah, okay, yeah.
Yeah, I'm actually channeling, because since I've usually read all or most of the stories by the time I do get to the interpretation phase, the phase of writing those interpretations, I can think not just of the stable of people that I know I disagree with, but some of the people who told the stories that were most striking and stood out in my memory as, you know, maybe the weirdest, or, you know, that had a perspective. And if it's a lively enough topic, there's always some stories in there that are really forceful and really like, you know, how someone felt, and I can sort of pretend to be that person, you know. And I think anybody can do this. It just takes practice. It does take emotional effort, though. I find that stage of the thing kind of bogs down, because it takes a lot of emotional effort to do that, to write down something you disagree with and treat it with respect, you know?
Yeah, that's why tomorrow we have a small session in the municipality, and I just discussed with Marco that we're going to do what you said the people wouldn't do. We give them prints, but we also give them a laptop and say, okay, do you want this colored by nature, colored by...
Oh, yes, yeah, some people will do it. It depends on the group. But with a lot of corporate and government types, it's just going to happen. Yeah.
In this case, it's civil servants looking at stories from citizens.
How close they are to the citizens. A lot of the projects that I worked on in the past, further back, were like 10 levels up from the citizens.
Yeah, okay.
And they just didn't want to hear it. They didn't want to do that part.
These are the civil servants. No, sorry, these are the social workers.
Social workers are very different
from
other civil servants, yeah.
The final thing that struck me, or that occurred to me, is it looks like this whole catalysis observation multi-perspective thing is the best practice of taking Cynthia, making Cynthia a non-participant. So all the other stages are as participatory as possible, while in catalysis you should remove the interpreter from the process, or do the catalysis with people from the organization so that you can go back into facilitation mode.
Well, I actually think that this entire thing is totally doable in a group.
Yeah.
But you have to choose this. You have to use the same rules. The same rules have to apply because you can have a lot of groupthink going on. So you have to say to people, okay, here's your task. You're going to look at this graph and you're going to come up with competing interpretations of it. And, you know, some of them can be your own interpretations, but you've got to come up with some things you disagree with.
Yeah.
That someone might legitimately think. And then you move forward and then you can use that. And maybe what would happen is like groups would pass that on to other groups, and then the sense making, it would like intermerge with the sense making. The problem is I can't ever get anybody to do it because it's a hard thing to do. It takes a little practice and it's hard to facilitate.
Yeah. Well, I think that the organizations where you can do this are in the security field. These organizations have enormous amounts of time because usually nothing happens.
Well, actually, it's kind of similar to the red teaming thing, red-blue teaming thing that people do. Yeah. So some of the defense people, you say this to them and they're like, oh yeah, we get that. And they can even do it in groups because they're used to checking their thinking by switching things around. Not all of them, but some of them. So, you know, some of that is actually born out of the work that we did for the Departments of Defense in two different countries, so that we were actually working with people who had these things. And you'd say, okay, let's red team this. And they'd be like, okay, got it.
Well, to tell you a little secret, just last week, I added this is a red teaming story to our security dashboard because the customer said, how do we gonna get out and do the analysis or the evaluation of the patterns without the red teaming? Because it disturbs our natural operations. Yeah, that's really funny. Yeah, so to cut the whole story short, catalysis is about taking the project leader out of the project to enable participation in the sense-making session.
As I was telling you the other day, I think I didn't make clear enough the connection with the word roots of this, which is that the Greek word kata means up, or the Greek word kata means down, like a katabatic wind is moving. I'm not sure if I got that right, but anyway, kata means down or sort of breaking down or coming apart, and ana means up or forward or together. And so analysis is sort of pulling things together and going forward and creating this sort of unified whole. And the reason I wanted to use catalysis is it's a breaking down. And I was thinking this great metaphor, which is that analysis is like a brick wall. right? It's a solid entity. It's built of bricks, but it's held together strongly. And you can't really do much with a brick wall except it's a wall, right? Mm-hmm. But catalysis is like a pile of bricks, right? They're not stuck to each other. You can do all kinds of things with them. You can put them together, take them apart, put them together again. And that's why it has value for sense making. You can analysis. A brick wall is no use for sense making because it means taking things apart and putting them back together over and over again to play with them, you know, so you can learn.
Well, my co-promoter is a Greek who speaks all the Greek languages, so old Greek linear bed, or what is it? And I just last month I found a word called catalytics in economy, and I was hoping it was related to catalysis. So I asked him the question, what's in Greek, what does catalytics and catalysis mean? It turned out one word was catalytics and the other word was catalysis. So yeah.
Well, lysis means breaking, actually.
And he said
lysis is breaking itself.
Cata is on, in, against, or upon.
Well, a catabatic wind is a down, is descending air, and an anabatic wind is uplifting air. So that's one of the ways it's used. But yeah. I think they were used for mean a lot of things. But also catabolic equations, processes in biology break down molecules, and anabolic processes build molecules.
Yeah.
So there's kind of this putting together and taking apart thing to it, the way they're used for a lot of different terms.
Can I ask one quick question? When you go into the sense making, do you have like two streams of sense making then? The stuff that's come from catalysis and the stuff that's story cards straight from story collection?
Yes. In fact, I always say to do the story part first. The people have to gain access to the stories and feel that they understand the stories before you can bring in the catalysis stuff. Because if you bring in the catalysis stuff first, it doesn't feel like it came from anywhere. And then it's just like, why are we looking at these graphs? This is nothing.
Well, Cynthia, that depends on your participants, because we had two sessions where we had an economist, an econometrist. These guys can't read. They only look at figures. So he demanded the histograms and the other things. I'm not going to read all this story.
Yeah, that's true. In fact, in that situation, you might need to show the graphs to get them to look at the story.
Well, we had the graphs on the wall. Uh-huh. We had the graphs on the wall and the story cards on the table. Most people, it was early in the morning, started reading. But there was one guy that stood up and started looking at, and he turned out to be the econometrist.
Well, I guess that's a good idea, actually, to have both options. Although, if you're giving people tasks, sometimes you kind of have to pick for them, or else they'll just flounder.
Yeah, but if you do soaking in the stories, why not soaking in the histograms for the one person that wants to do it? I mean,
I think for most people, the stories and the connections are
95% go for the stories. And if there's one guy that goes to the histograms, let him do it.
Right.
By the way, we had the discussion before this week. I think catalysis report. I once worked with a cybernetician who was talking about information sets. So he talked about info set. And I think info set is a reasonable word to describe the contents of a, not information in the sense of IT information, but if you would call it the catalysis set or the catalysis information.
Well, I always call it catalysis materials.
Yeah.
Is my preferred term. The problem is that a lot of corporate clients, they're just in love with the word report.
They want report.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Can you call it binder or?
I think you can. What you can call it depends on what kind of person, people you're working with.
We notice that too. People want to buy something.
Yeah.
They say, okay, this is one of the outputs of the project that I can file although it doesn't mean anything to them, that's a physical output from the project that said, okay, so that's what we're paying for.
And for people like that, you can also make a sense-making report.
Yeah.
Which is a report on what happened at the sense-making session. You record it, you make take notes, you take photographs, and then you make a record of what happened. Yeah. And then there's another thing, and they're like, oh, we love this thing. And in fact, if they are of that frame of mind, it's really better to make the sense-making report, because otherwise they will criticize the catalysis report as not.
Well, you could say that the project plan is the part from the is the output from the planning. The story cards are the output from the collection. Catalysis set or by, so you have a physical output. The only problem is it takes a lot of hours, so it's pretty expensive to make all these things, and then suddenly there's another discussion.
Yeah, well, time takes time is what I always say.
Talking about time, we're almost 2 hours into the call.
Yeah, that is kind of standard for us, but I think we've had a really great discussion this time.